I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I gotta say, when you spend like a few thousand hours of your life watching and rewatching the show The Office, you don't expect that one day Dwight Schrute is gonna talk to you about faith. But Rainn Wilson, the actor who played Dwight, has written a new book about his own faith, why spirituality is a big part of being an artist, and why it's kind of a risk for anyone in the public eye to talk about religion. That's coming up. Plus, have you ever sat down and talked to your grandparents about their lives, or even your parents about their lives? In particular, the stuff that's not so easy to talk about. Mayumi Lashbrook is a Canadian dancer. She sat down to talk to her grandfather for the first time about his time in a Japanese internment camp. And she'll tell you how that felt, what she learned, how she's taken his story and turned it into a new dance show, how she feels that her grandfather is coming to see it. Mayumi Lashbrook, coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So yeah, if you spent any time watching The Office, like the U.S. version of The Office, there's one character that kind of steals the show. Beat-growing, bobblehead-collecting, nunchuck-wielding assistant to the regional manager, Dwight Schrute. Now, if you haven't seen the show, he sounds like this.
When my mother was pregnant with me, they did an ultrasound and found she was having twins. When they did another ultrasound a few weeks later, they discovered that I had resorbed the other fetus. I now have the strength of a grown man and a little baby.
So for 9 seasons, Rainn Wilson played Dwight Schrute on The Office. It made him world famous pretty much overnight. But he believes a lot of his success in his career comes from something you don't typically hear about on red carpets or entertainment magazines. Well, Rainn Wilson has a new book. It's called Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution, where he talks about his faith. He talks about why there's a strong connection between art and spirituality and what happens to our world now that it has less spirituality in it. I should be clear, like, this book is not about religion. It's not trying to convert anybody into religion. But we talk about the roles he's played and the spirituality he's brought to them, why he felt like he needed to reject spirituality to be a great artist, and a little bit about how religious people are portrayed in film and TV. But we started out by talking about how I felt funny playing him a clip from The Office. Here's my conversation with Rainn Wilson. I don't know why I felt a little sheepish with the Dwight clip. I think I was like, oh my God, has this guy heard these clips and has talked about this character too many times?
I certainly talk about the character a lot, but at the same time, we got to hook in those Canadians, Tom. Canadians love The Office. We got some Dwight quotes. They're like, oh, that perked him up. Comedy. Everyone knows Canada has a sterling sense of humor. Some of the greatest comedy in the world history has come out of your rinky-dink little nation over
there.
Oh,
my God. Do I have to come down there and defend?
Oh, fisticuffs, my lad.
Do I have to come down there, wherever you are, in that walled-off room and take you? I'll do it. I'll do it.
I'm sure you will, hockey stick or no.
Oh, my God. This feels like I'm going to be brought up in front of a tribunal. Congratulations on the book. I loved reading it. And I guess to start things off, faith can be a very private thing for people. Why did you want to talk about yours openly?
Well, I certainly do talk about my faith openly, which I'm a member of the Baha'i faith, and I bring that up. This is not a Baha'i book or for Baha'is or about Baha'i, but I speak about that because I speak about my faith because it's a big reality of me. I'm also a Seahawks fan, and I speak about being a Seahawks fan. I'm also a fan of tennis and chess, and I talk about tennis and chess and Radiohead, and I love Radiohead, and I like to talk about Radiohead. So many people don't talk about faith for a good reason, because it can be off-putting to some, and it's a little bit scary or afraid you're being judged. But more than faith, I wanted to talk about spirituality. I wanted to talk about deep, big, meaningful, gooey spiritual questions.
Let's talk about your own path there. You write in the book, my entire childhood was filled with two things, art and spirituality. Talk to me about how those things collided for you as a kid.
Yeah, so I grew up a member of the Baha'i faith, and my dad was an artist or an aspiring artist or a wannabe artist. He painted on canvases all the time. He would blast opera music and sing at the top of his lungs. He wrote books of poetry that no one ever read. He wrote science fiction novels that very few people only read. There's only one of his books called Tentacles of Dawn that still exists in paperback. Came out in like 1976 or something like that.
Cool.
Yeah. And we had, and we were, because we were Baha'is and Baha'is are accepting of all of the world's faiths, we had people stopping by our doors and knocking, and we would bring in the born again Christians to talk about the Bible, and we would have Buddhist monks over, Sikhs and Sufis, people of all different religious faiths, and we would talk to them about God or the Bible or whatever they wanted to talk to. Our bookshelves were filled with religious tomes. So these kind of deep, wonderful, profound, and sometimes overwhelming faith-based ideas really made the go-round in our household.
Despite that very spiritual childhood, you've talked about how when you were a young actor starting out at NYU, you sort of moved away from spirituality. You moved away from faith a little bit. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I, like so many do, I had no room in my life for God. I thought that was just a ridiculous concept. I swiftly turned to being an atheist. I didn't want morality in my life. I didn't want the religion of my parents in my life. I just had no time or interest in any of that. I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to do comedy. I wanted to tell stories in the theater. And I wanted to live a bohemian life in New York City. And I did for many years. And it was great. It was wonderful until it wasn't as wonderful anymore. And I started to get extremely unhappy. And I dealt with kind of a mental health crisis of my own in the 90s when I was in my 20s living in New York City. I was overwhelmed, anxious, depressed, dealing with addiction, loneliness, disconnection. And, you know, about the 47th time I woke up at 3 a.m. staring at the ceiling going, what does it all mean? I thought, well, maybe, I've thrown the spiritual baby out with the religious bathwater. And maybe, just maybe, I have been premature in ejecting anything and everything to do with religion and spirituality. And that started me on a quest. You know, I'll quote the great author Julia Cameron, who said, I come to spirituality not out of virtue, but out of necessity.
But there's one sort of thing I might need you to help me understand a little bit there, is that if you grow up with parents who are artists and are able to have a spiritual life, when you made the decision to be an artist, why did you feel like that thing that would be incongruent?
Mostly it had to do, I'll be really honest and really frank, mostly it had to do with morality. In the Baha'i faith, as in so many faiths, there are, you know, strictures around sex and drugs and alcohol and behavior. And I wanted to participate in sex and drugs and alcohol and behaviors that weren't incongruent with Baha'i teachings. And I wanted to do things for myself. I wanted to be selfish. I wanted to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. I didn't want to think about other people. I didn't want to think about trying to make the world a better place and be of service and pray and meditate. I didn't want a part of all that. I wanted to have maximum fun and be maximum actor artist guy.
How do you exist in show business, which is the entertainment industry is one we're told prioritizes social capital, popularity, money, perhaps, you know, almost more than any other industry. How have you found reconciling the world that you live in with the spiritual tools you've practiced?
You're absolutely right. It can be incredibly challenging. I remember one time when I was a starving actor, I was offered a role in a television show playing a character that was profligate, sexual deviant, and drug user and drunk. And the source of the comedy is that the guy was always hung over and always had some new girl over, and very funny, haha. And I turned it down because I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be associated with that. And I'm not trying to be prudish and no. I'm not trying to be like puritanical. It's like, I just wouldn't feel good about myself kind of essentially promoting that kind of way of being in the world and having that way of being. If I was playing that character in a movie for a limited period of time, but you're talking about signing a 5, 6, 7 year contract for a television show. So that was a very difficult decision, but I had to turn it down. And you're right. There's Hollywood is rife with hypocrisy for any spiritual person. You know, The Office was on the air for one reason only, and that was to sell stuff during commercial breaks. It was to sell cars and trucks and Dr. Scholl's foot inserts and, you know, hats and baby powder, whatever else people buy as they're watching a television show. So I was part of this giant capitalist enterprise of NBC Universal just trying to make gobs of money. And guess what they did? They made gobs of money. But I will say the greater service is that we made people laugh.
Oh, hey, Dwight.
I'm going to be your new boss. Welcome to the hotel hell. Check-in time is now. Check-out time is never.
Does my room have cable?
No. And the sheets are made of fire.
I tell you, it has been such a balm to my heart to hear from people over the years how much The Office has meant to them. It's cheered their hearts. They were going through a hard time. They were dealing with anxiety or depression. Their parents were getting a divorce. Someone in the family was sick. And The Office brought them solace and brought them joy. So you do what you can within the system that you work.
I'll tell you, I said this to your former castmate, John Krasinski, not that long ago. I'm one of them. When my dad died, I experienced about as close as up to that point I had ever experienced depression. Like I didn't, I remember having this experience after my father died, and I come from a spiritual household. And I remember having this feeling of like, oh, this must be what depression is. Like there was a deep hole, a sadness that I couldn't get out of. And I remember going upstairs to my grandmother's, she wasn't there, my grandmother's apartment, and hooking up my Xbox to my grandmother's like old 70s TV, you know, those ones with the cabinets in it, somehow hooking that up. Mm-hmm. And playing The Office DVDs over and over and over again to get through that. I wasn't planning on telling you that, but now that you mention it, like to get through the darkest moment of my life.
Oh, nice. Nice. So you talked at the beginning about the intersection between art and faith. One of the things art can do is bring joy and inspiration to people's hearts. So you have this beautiful creative act where there is an empty page or an empty stage or an empty screen, and then you fill it with something beautiful and lasting and a storytelling, an act of storytelling that uplifts people and enlivens them and gives back to them. I know that think about the world without art, think about the world without music, without stories, without films or theater or poetry, what an emptier place it would be.
And it's a beautiful thing. Plus I feel like there was a spiritual, you're going to laugh at this, I feel like there was a spiritual component to Dwight. Like he was like obviously of a faith. Like he was of a, you know, he seemed to be like Amish or Pennsylvania Dutch or something like that. You know, there were priests involved. It didn't feel like he was entirely bereft of a spiritual life, you know?
Well, he had a traditional religious life. I don't know how spiritual Dwight was. I think of Dwight as kind of a 19th century man. He would have fit right in like the 1860s or something like that. He was very much about hierarchies, very much about family, about tradition, about his plot of land and the right way to do things.
The Schrutes have their own traditions. We usually marry standing in our own graves. It makes the funerals very romantic, but the weddings are a bleak affair.
I'm not sure Dwight was terribly spiritually evolved.
I mean,
not the kind of evolution that I'm urging people toward.
You know, if it wasn't you, I'd argue about it, but I'm not going to argue with you about it. But okay. I feel like on 6 Feet Under, which was the HBO show about a family that runs a funeral home. I mean, what was it like for you as a person who was interested in spirituality at that point to talk? I mean, to act out some pretty big concepts, spiritual concepts on that show.
Yeah, that was a profound show. a deep exploration of the human condition. Every episode started with a death.
Cancer.
Yes, cancer.
I'm here for you.
Okay, better, but use we're here, not I'm here. You're not their friend. And easy on the touching. Even funeral directors have to beware of transference.
6 Feet Under beautifully encapsulated this idea that in death, we learn about life. And I know that this was profound for me. The passing of my father kind of framed for me the importance of life itself and probed me and prodded me and poked me and cajoled me ever deeper into exploring what it means to be a spiritual being having a human experience.
Well, I admire you for having the conversation because, as I said at the beginning, as anyone who has sort of a public-facing job, as you do, you're sort of putting yourself at risk whenever you start to have these conversations. Like I heard a story about you that you pitched Netflix a show about God or something like that.
Yep. I talk about that. I was pitching a show. In fact, this was how the book was inspired. It was I wanted to do a television show about God called The Notorious G.O.D. And I went around. I had a great sizzle reel and pitch deck. We had episode ideas. We wanted to look at God like AI and what's a modern conception of God? How do we reimagine God in the modern world? How do different cultures look at God? As opposed to getting away from this patriarchal old man with a beard type of nonsense. And we pitched it around. People were very receptive. And at the end of the day, it was rejected across the board. And I'll never forget, at Netflix, they said, "I'm sorry, the topic is too controversial. You can have television shows with like half-naked models throwing garbage at each other and getting drunk on, you know, that's fine. But having conversations about God and the meaning of life and, you know, what's beyond is too controversial. This is how upside down our culture is right now."
I think I saw that. What was that? You had a tweet, sort of a series of tweets around the Last of Us, right? Like there was a preacher character on there, and you sort of said, "Well, I know that this is given the way our society is right now. There's no way this character is going to be a good character."
Yeah. So I loved the show The Last of Us, and there was an episode where there was a preacher preaching to his post-apocalyptic congregation. From the Bible. And in a second, I was just like, oh, he's evil.
Revelation 21. "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away."
And sure enough, not only was he evil, he was like the evilest person you've, in a plethora of evil. He was a cannibalistic pedophile. It doesn't get more evil than this guy.
"If you want to judge me..."
"Judge you? You're eating people, you sick..."
"There are only a few of us that know."
"You're an animal."
"Well, yes, we all are. That's sort of the point."
First of all, I thought, well, that's just lazy writing. And then I thought, well, wait a second. Why is Hollywood always doing this? So I tweeted out, Hollywood has this anti-Christian bias. And of course, I was feted on right-wing news sites for this observation and made it a hero on Fox News. When a month previous, all these right-wing news sites were tearing me down for my actions and my views on climate change. So how swiftly the tables turn. But and so many Christian friends texted me and wrote me and said, "Thank you for that. Thank you so much for saying something." And I do think I know a lot of Christians, they're nice people. They're good people. They're trying to make the world better. They're having potlucks. They're trying to be loving family members. They're not fire and brimstone people trying to, you know, damn everyone that doesn't agree with them in exactly the same way. Why aren't there shows with just normal, loving Christians sometimes? You know, not all the time, but occasionally.
I mean, I suppose, you know, there's been so much bad done in the name of the church. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's been so much bad done by people, in particular powers, by priests. I guess I would understand a little bit if that was an easy character to write. If that was if we as a society started to look at some of these people who find themselves in positions of power like that and looked at them with a bit of a skeptical eye.
Some of the worst crimes imaginable in human history have been done by the church.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
And the revelations around the Catholic Church over the last couple of decades and the child abuse scandals is horrific. Some of the best people I've ever met have also been of the church and of the cloth. So this is a dichotomy. You know, there are good people and bad people. There are good systems and bad systems and corrupt systems. And but our job as storytellers is to try and illumine the human condition. And I think it's also a shame that so much around religion has been polarized and dichotomized. I don't even know if that's a word, because of the left and right schism that exists in the United States. I don't know how deep it is in Canada, but in the United States, this blue state, red state divide seems to be pitting the secular versus the Christian, and one side views the other side as evil and wanting the destruction of the country itself. And religion kind of gets caught up in the middle of that. And by the way, I'm not even a Christian. I'm a Baha'i who's talking all of this.
Well, I realize also I'm sort of putting you on the hook for all world religions here. You know, like you're sure. You've become the ambassador to me of all world faith. Let me close off maybe this way. I was going to end this interview by asking about how spirituality might help you in the life of an artist, which is notoriously hard. But I think you've sort of acknowledged that, and you sort of talked to me a little bit about that. But talk to me about a tool, either in your book or just in your own life, that in a time of great bleakness that we live in right now, a time when like the world is a dumpster fire, is such a like widely accepted, almost cliched meme at this point. What helps you when your head hits the pillow at night?
What helps me when my head hits the pillow is a deep understanding that one of my sacred jobs is to bring joy and squash cynicism. I remember I got to study with the great acting teacher Andre Gregory for a spell in New York City in the 90s. And he was the subject of the movie My Dinner with Andre.
We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now may very well be a self-perpetuating, unconscious form of brainwashing?
And he would sit down with his students and have tea. I had tea with him, and he said, "So how are you doing, Rain?" And I was like, "Well, I'm feeling cynical. I'm feeling pessimistic. The world's going to crap, and I don't know, blah, blah, blah." This was, by the way, this was the late 90s. The world was doing pretty great back then, you know? Now that we look back, and he grabbed my arm and he said, don't do it. Don't be cynical. Don't be pessimistic. If you're cynical, they win. If you're hopeless, the forces of darkness win. They want you to be cynical. Don't you see? They want you to be pessimistic because then you won't do anything. The more cynical you are, the more pessimistic you are, the less active you will be to changing the world. And I think joy can be harnessed for good. I think it's a superpower. It's a service to others. And you don't have to be an actor. You don't have to be a sitcom star to bring joy to people. You can be an accountant or a school teacher or a bus driver. It really doesn't matter. If everyone worked every day to bring joy and squash cynicism, even just 10%, the world would already be a better place. And action can be much more fertile and snowball, and a collective action toward making the world a better place can be inspired.
Rainn Wilson, thanks so much for your time today. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you for having me.
Rainn Wilson's new book is called Soul Boom: Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And if you've watched The Office at all, you might know why we're playing you this one.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams.
That is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Teach Your Children. I have to say, Dwight and Michael singing that in The Office, one of my favorite moments. My conversation with Rainn Wilson before that about his new book, Soul Boom: Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. Coming up, the Canadian dancer Mayumi Lashbrook, about talking to her grandfather about his time in a Japanese internment camp and deciding to take his story
and tell it through dance. It's after this on Q.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I noticed really early on how taxing it was on my emotional stability and my nervous system, and the cast noticed as well. So as an ensemble, we decided to create a ritual of entering and exiting the piece.
It's one thing to take on like a traumatic role. It's another thing when that role ends for the night and you have to go back to your real life. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. The artist you heard just there's name is Mayumi Lashbrook. She's a dancer and choreographer who grew up in Toronto. All her life, she's been wondering some things about her grandfather. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941, he was one of tens of thousands of Japanese Canadians forcibly removed from their homes and sent to live in remote camps. It's one of the worst human rights violations in Canadian history. And Mayumi's grandfather, well, he didn't really like to talk about it. I mean, she would ask him about it, but, you know, he didn't really have much to say. He'd sort of get his children to speak for him. So it's kind of poetic now, I got to say, that she's telling his story with very few words. Mayumi is the choreographer of a new dance piece called Enemy Lines. We talked a little bit about what happened when her grandfather opened up to her, the pressure of trying to tell his story and her own story through dance, and how, as I mentioned, when you have to embody trauma on stage, how do you go about the rest of your evening? Here's my conversation with Mayumi Lashbrook. How are you?
Good, thank you. Excited to be here.
Nice to have you here. Very exciting to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's talk about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. You would ask your grandfather, what do you call your grandfather, by the way?
Grandpa, yeah.
Grandpa.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'd say grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of a pop guy.
Yeah. I wish I had used Ji-chan, but it didn't happen in my family.
Oh, okay.
It's always the English.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. So grandpa.
Yeah.
You know, what happened during the war, and, mm-hmm. and he would be pretty quiet, right?
Mm-hmm. It was usually that he'd defer to my mom. My mom would answer the questions or bring it up even. He wasn't really excited to talk about it. And it wasn't until I started to actually interview him for this project that he opened up. And it took us two or three different interviews before he really was like, okay, I'm excited to talk about it. And now he almost brings it up himself if he can, which is really beautiful.
So I understand this better. You were younger, like you were a younger person, mm-hmm. sort of like asking casually, like, wait, what was your life like during the war? And he would just button up kind of.
Yeah, yeah. He'd defer to my mom.
and he'd say, you know, and your mom would tell you a little bit?
Yeah, yeah. She really tried to like prepare me to understand what it meant to be Japanese in Canadian society. So it was her way of almost protecting me. But for him, he really couldn't grapple with it. He couldn't understand how to support me in that or how the history was still alive for other people.
So what changed? You one day you say this is going to be, I'm going to maybe try and make something out of this, and he decides he wants to open up?
Mm-hmm. I approached him about an interview to start. We ended up doing two different ones. And yeah, he was quite close-lipped about it, but I came with questions and those questions started unfolding more and more about the story. It's almost like it's given him permission to talk about it, something that he hasn't really wanted to, and now he wants to.
How does that feel for you to be present for that?
Really special. I feel a deep privilege in the fact that he's willing to open up about it and that this gift of the performance is what's brought it out of him. It's brought my whole family closer,
yeah.
In fact. Yeah.
Would you mind telling me the story?
Mm-hmm. My grandfather was 11 when he was interned, and he was sent to sugar beet farms in Manitoba.
Where was he before that?
He was in Surrey, BC.
Surrey.
Yeah. And so him and his two sisters and his mother moved to Manitoba They lived on a small farm with another family, and so they were lucky that they had other people to support them. And they opted for voluntary repatriation in 1945, which meant as a teenager, he was sent to Japan for the first time. So he's 19 years old, discovering a war-torn Japan and trying to figure out who he is. And he was met with perhaps even more scorn and discrimination in Japan than he was in Canada.
Really? Why is that?
Because he couldn't fully speak Japanese. They also smelt it on him. They understood that he wasn't from there. So they really persecuted him in ways that he wasn't expecting.
I mean, what a feeling to be sort of not Canadian enough for Canada and not Japanese enough for Japan.
Exactly.
What stories did he tell you about his time in internment camp?
Mm-hmm. He didn't have a lot. He was young, and I think he was really thrown into work life right away. At age 11, he was forced to be man of the house of a small farm, and really forced to do physical labor right away. So I think it was, my understanding is that it was pretty monotonous in that, and that he didn't have a lot of say in what he was doing. He did talk about the fact that he'd go to school as well, but also the kids were truly unkind to him there. Yeah.
What made you want to tell this story through dance, of all things?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've grown up as a dancer. It's my mode of expression for many years. And so it felt like the best way I knew to understand the story and to share it with others, that it's quite a burden to understand this history that's come before me. And it was a way of alleviating that burden in some fashion.
Hold on. Let me understand that better. Like, you felt that burden?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What did that burden feel like? What?
It feels like the expectations of others of carrying the story forward. Being a descendant of someone who survived the internment means that it feels like the weight has fallen on me to keep the story going.
Right.
And so I have taken that on in this piece, Enemy Lines, and discovered more about myself through it and what I can offer others in that history. It's really revealed the cycles of oppression that we live within to me and the fear-based knowledge that we live within now that was present then and really led to the internment. And so I feel like an advocate in trying to understand that fear and where it holds us back from connection. So that already felt like something I was interested in as an artist, as a person, and was curious about how can I create that in a dance that others can take away a similar thought.
Well, yeah, with all respect, and I don't know if you can tell from looking at me, I'm not much of a dancer.
That's
don't,
okay.
I don't. By the way, I don't appreciate the laughter. but the dance is in my stunted knowledge of it. Is not given necessarily to linear storytelling, to a story that is beginning and a middle and end. It's largely given to more abstract storytelling, to more emotional storytelling. How do you approach telling sort of like a narrative story through mm-hmm. dance?
I did a lot of work to figure that out because I have seen a lot of dance in my life, and a lot of it, like you named, doesn't have story to it. It's very abstract, and I wanted this to be something that an audience member could come in, understand it, grasp it, and take it home for themselves in some way. And so I started working with Denise Fujiwara. She's my mentor, and asked her a lot of questions of how she builds narrative, how does she work, and started from there. I put all these sticky notes up on my wall of like beginning, middle, end. What are the different parts? How does the story work? How do the characters evolve? And I went from there. I also really questioned, when I do this action, what does that say? And not to me as a dancer, to someone else who doesn't know dance. So I think a lot of dance, when you lift your leg in the air, it doesn't really say anything per chance. Like it is an action,
yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily say, I feel this way.
Yeah, or, that's right.
Exactly. So I was like, okay, what else can I do? If I use a heart symbol with my hands, what does that say? That's love, right?
Yeah.
We know and understand that. So utilizing tools like that of communication through the body was really where I wanted to go with this.
Are you able to, I know this is the radio and it's challenging, are you able to tell me what this thing looks like if I was sitting in the audience?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, you can tell me how good I did at this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not asking you to dance it now in the radio because that might be even worse.
Even worse.
Yeah, I'm ready.
So the arc of the narrative is that we start in present day, and I discover this trunk that my grandfather would have used to go back and forth from Canada to Japan. And discovering this trunk opens up my ability to see this past, and I'm transported back in time to firsthand go through the internment as my great-grandmother would have. There's even letters that I have found from her that are a part of the audio experience. So it's very linear of what happened in the internment in that historic moment. Mm. And then I'm transported back to our current time, and we see me as Mayumi grappling with this information of this history that's come before me, trying to make sense of it, and then reaching out to others. How do I want to connect? How do I want my interpersonal relationships to look like? And can I make choices that bring people closer together or make them farther? Like what are the choices and autonomy I have in creating a culture of shared history that looks at a brighter future where we are living more interdependently and caring for one another in ways that weren't capable or weren't possible in the war period?
There's a heaviness I can only imagine from sitting down and even just talking to your grandfather about this. I mean, him telling you some pretty harrowing, awful things that he went through. There's a heaviness, right, that you get up from those conversations feeling, I'm sure, a bit rocked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then you have to inhabit them, to dance them, to portray them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel after a day, not only the physical aspect of it, but like the emotional weight of that? How do you feel at the end of like a rehearsal period or the end of a show? Or
yeah, I feel heavy, absolutely. I noticed really early on how taxing it was on my emotional stability and my nervous system, and the cast noticed as well. So as an ensemble, we decided to create a ritual of entering and exiting the piece. So it's something that we do collectively to drop into character, to drop into the piece itself.
What is it? Can you tell me?
Yeah, we stand and touch hands, mm-hmm. and then close our eyes, take a breath together, mm-hmm. and then we tap each other's fingers. So it's a nice little way to remind ourselves that we care for each other, that we're here in connection and collaboration to create the show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we exit by tapping our full body, which is also a somatic tool to really calm the nervous system.
Like tapping your chests and tapping your...
Exactly. Head, chest, all the way down to your toes.
What do you do afterwards? How do you blow off steam after something like that?
Mm-hmm. What do I do? I mean, my self-care routine is definitely a hot bath. It is the best thing for my body. It's also a way to tune out. I put on a podcast or read a book or whatnot, and just chill in the bathtub, because that's the best way for me.
I know from people who told me stories like that before, like they'll get off stage of portraying something really kind of harrowing like that, and they'll go back to their dressing room and they'll play like Candy Crush or something like that. Or they'll put on a song by so-and-so, you know, and that helps them out. You know what I mean?
Totally, totally. I think I'm really lucky because I have a cast that is, they're wonderful characters. They're beautiful people. So I'm able to laugh with them, and that's really gratifying. I think if this was a solo, it would have been a lot harder to come back out. But the way we're able to hold space for each other makes it a lot easier.
You mentioned earlier that you are mentored by the great Japanese-Canadian dancer Denise Fujiwara, that she helped you figure out how to tell a linear story through dance. Mm-hmm. But just in general, I'm really interested in the sort of the mentor-mentee relationship. Mm-hmm. What's the piece of advice that she's given you that has sort of meant the most to you in this?
In creating Enemy Lines, the thing I have carried with me through the whole process was that it takes courage to make great art. And it was so easy for me to back away from this story. It was so much easier just to be like, oh, it's a pretty dance and that's okay. But that courage, that key word for me of it takes courage to do this, I continually came back in that room and was like, no, push harder. You can get more out of this. You can get a richer story. And so her offering of that has allowed me to continually mine it. If you were writing a book, you would keep writing it over and over again. So that's essentially what I did in dance. I kept re-choreographing it, kept taking pieces out, putting them in based on her
recommendation.
That's the word.
I got you. I'm here for you. I'm here. I'm here for you. I got you. Based on her recommendation.
Based on her recommendation.
Wow. So that relationship's meaningful to you?
Very much so. Yeah.
How old's your grandfather now?
He's 92.
Can Can I ask his name?
Yeah, his name's Tatsumi Sumioka.
And is he coming to the show?
He is. He's coming on the Sunday show with my mom. And
how are you feeling about that?
Nervous but excited. His attention span's really an hour. And so I'm lucky that this piece is 50 minutes. He'll be able to sit through it, which is great. And I've been bringing him to more Japanese-Canadian works of art because they're more and more important to me. And so it's a point of connection for the two of us that we've grown into as our relationship has developed. And so I feel more excited to share something with him that's actually mine, that this is a point that we've been able to connect on and an even deeper one. So I'm really excited to show him.
I bet you are. I mean, this is something that he just didn't want to go back to the beginning of our conversation. He just didn't want to talk to you. Not that he didn't want to talk to you about it, but he couldn't really talk to you about it all. And now he gets to see that story sort of told.
Totally.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Miami Lashbrook is a dancer, choreographer, and the co-artistic director of, Aris Korper?
Aris Korper, you got it.
No flies on me, contemporary dance. Her show, Enemy Lines, will be in Hamilton, Ontario from May 26th to the 28th. All right, that is it for us today. Tomorrow on the show, you're going to hear my conversation with Fall Out Boy, one of the most successful pop punk bands of all time. Stadiums, millions of album sales, legions of fans. But they told me in our interview that the secret to their success is to set a low bar. Their new album, So Much for Stardust, is out now. They'll be here to talk about that. See you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.